Ladies and gentlemen, Saturday, February the 21st, and here now is a roundup of the latest news at home and abroad as reported by our foreign correspondents. Now, we take you first today to London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. The British have no news from Timor and Bali today. There's no confirmation in London of Japanese landings in Java. The latest from Burma is that fierce fighting with heavy casualties on both sides is still going on around the Bilin River positions. In Libya, patrols on both sides are feeling out the strength of the massing forces. I had a long talk with General de Gaulle last night. As always, his comments on the development of the war were crystal clear, the product of a reflective mind that's sure of itself and sure of its conclusions. With his family and intimate friends, de Gaulle's conversation is lightened with a droll wit that doesn't appear in his public statements. The general expressed great interest in American war effort. He realizes the psychological value to the country of speedy organization of a large mass army, but he points out that battles are not won by masses. He believes, and the German army adopted his belief, that the only thing that really counts is how much mechanized material a country can actually put in use. He says, if a country has an army of 10 men, it must be able to use all 10. If it has an air force of 1,000 planes, it must be able to use 1,000 planes. De Gaulle says, for instance, that it's not how many men Britain and America can keep under arms in their own countries that will win the war. It's how big a striking force, fully equipped with tanks, planes, and guns, can be shifted quickly to any theater of war. The Free French leader has great admiration for General MacArthur, the admiration of one fighting man for another. And he thinks the Battle of Bataan is a great moral victory, proving that Americans can face great odds and keep on fighting successfully. De Gaulle was talking about the number of men now in the American army, and he said, you see, if MacArthur had had 3 armored divisions, a relatively small number of men, he would still control the Philippines. He said that if America had been in a position to send 1 complete mechanized division to Libya a month or so ago, Rommel would probably have been decisively beaten. But to be mobile in this world war, an army must have ships. De Gaulle points out that without the ships to transport them, millions of men and quantities of material are locked up useless inside the United States and Britain. I asked the general whether he believed the Germans would try to invade England. He doesn't think that with the Russians pressing against them in the east, the Germans can spare enough men and material to try an invasion. The invasion of Britain would take thousands of planes and a huge quantity of ships, and de Gaulle doesn't think the Germans have enough to make invasion a probability this summer. But the Free French general does think the Germans will carry out an offensive in the east, probably a thrust and a comparatively small front toward the Caucasus oil. Britain is guarded against invasion by huge armies, but de Gaulle says there's no reason to think the Germans aren't worried by the possibility that the British may carry out an invasion of the continent. He thinks the offensive spirit is an important factor in war, that the Allies should be taking every opportunity to hit out at the enemy, to put them on the defensive. And the troops now guarding Britain might well be used to strike at the Germans. De Gaulle recalls that the actual German striking force that conquered France was a fairly small, mobile, powerfully armored force. And he thinks the democracy's tendency toward mass armies, the drafting of men from war industries, is a wrong line of thought. I got the impression that he believed there should be greater concentration on building the tanks, ships, and planes, the equipment that can give an army effective hitting power. What wins battles, he says, is the force you are able to exert at the right time in the right place, not the potential force that you can't put into the conflict. De Gaulle is sure that France will, after the war, again be an important factor in world civilization. He's quietly confident when he talks about France, for he's sure the Free French represent the vast, mute mass of the French people. The Vichy government, he thinks, no longer has any intrinsic importance. It serves Hitler well by making a certain percentage of the people in unoccupied France believe they are no longer in the war. This is a potentially dangerous feeling, for if Germany is beaten and the French people feel they had no part in the victory, that it wasn't their victory just as much as that of Britain, Russia, and America, there'll be a smoldering discontent in France. And de Gaulle believes that peace in Europe after the war depends on one thing, just how long the United States, Britain, Russia, and France will cooperate. Just before I left him, I asked de Gaulle what he thought of the Riant trial. His first words summed up the feeling of every Frenchman I've met here. He said, in the first place, it isn't a trial. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Here in New York, we have two bulletins just been brought into the newsroom. The first is Dateline Batavia. A major naval battle, from all accounts, even bigger than the Battle of Makassar Straits, is being fought in the waters off Bali, it was reported today, with four Japanese warships already damaged by combined United States and Dutch naval forces. The fighting, which apparently began shortly after midnight yesterday in a sharp sea engagement between Bali and Lombok Islands, apparently still is going on. And from Rangoon, desperate attempts by Japanese invasion troops to penetrate the British held line west of the Baleen River have all been frustrated, officials declared today. Now we take you to the newsroom in San Francisco.
From the west coast of the United States, we take you out across the blue Pacific to the Hawaiian Islands. Go ahead, Honolulu.
This is Jim Wall speaking from KGU in Honolulu. It is 2:36 Saturday morning in Hawaii. The islands of Hawaii, forming the westernmost American bastion, stick out into the turbulent Pacific, to use common local parlance, like a sore thumb. But here we use the word sore in the sense of angry determination. And this thumb is pointed at Japan and ready to crush any prowling Japanese gadflies beneath it. We in Hawaii, nearly halfway to the war-shattered Orient, are in a peculiar position. We have a grandstand seat, and we're watching hour by hour developments in the Pacific with intense interest. Our interest is not just curiosity. Every man and woman in Hawaii, soldier, sailor, marine, civilian war worker, or office worker, realizes that the Pacific battle is rapidly approaching its gigantic climax, and that if the Japanese continue to make progress, as they have since the fall of Singapore, it is possible, if not probable, that they may turn their full attention toward us, rather than toward India or Russia. It was said by the complacent British that Singapore was invulnerable, but Singapore fell. We in Hawaii do not say that it can't happen here, but we're preparing to meet the showdown if it should happen here. Hawaii is the springboard from which the Army and Navy may take offensive action westward against the enemy. It is also the frontline defensive area in case of attack, particularly so now that the Japanese are overrunning the Philippines and Indies. As the threat draws closer, many developments in our daily existence may serve as indications of our preparedness. We've been living under strict martial law for nearly 3 months. That means, among other things, total blackout from dark to dawn, rigid curfew, and complete prohibition. Ours is no semi-blackout, as in many West Coast cities. If you're guilty of so much as lighting a cigarette on the street after dark, you're likely to be picked up by the tin-hatted sentries, whisked before an all-night army court, and heavily fined. The curfew is real. No one moves about after it rings unless specially permitted to do so. And there hasn't been a legal sale of a drink in formerly easygoing Hawaii since the first bombs fell. We won't mention pineapple swipes and lemon extract. We don't know what the future will bring, but we're getting ready. We realize that nowhere in this war-torn world are military regulations so rigidly enforced as here. Our blackout is blacker than London's. Our barbed wire fills every lonely beach. Every uniformed man and civilian carries a gas mask day and night. Many civilians also carry helmets. These regulations sometimes hurt, but there's no grumbling. We're too busy for that. We have rent control in Hawaii today to prevent profiteering. We have food price control for the same reason. We have a rigid rationing of gasoline. My home, for example, is on the other side of this island, 14 miles from Honolulu. But I haven't been able to live there since the war began, because it's too difficult to travel over the winding roads in total blackout, and because the gasoline rationing this month prohibits any idea of being able to move back. Everyone in Hawaii is making sacrifices such as these and thinking nothing of them. We expect to be inconvenienced by war, and many men who work hard 6 days a week go out on Sunday, their rest day, as volunteer workmen without pay to cut brush and trees and clear land which the Army wants to use. We used to have a 3-day weekend in lazy Honolulu. Today, we haven't got a half-day weekend. I tell you of these things because we have reports here that mainland cities have approached the state of martial law with considerable trepidation. We don't have to be reminded to remember Pearl Harbor. It's just a short way down the beach here. We're working toward the day when the Japanese will have good cause to long remember Pearl Harbor, too. I'll return you to San Francisco.
Now back across the continent to our newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. A great many of you interesting people write to me asking why someone does not rescue General MacArthur. I think the answer is that he would not be rescued if somebody even went after him. He could, they say, be taken away from there by an order from the commander-in-chief, the president. But his kind of men don't even obey orders like that because he has, I imagined, arranged so that if such an order came, he would never get it. That's possible. Lord Nelson signaled to withdraw from a naval engagement, put his telescope to his blind eye. I see nothing, he said, and went on fighting to victory. And in the log of the ship on which Nelson died, you'll find this. Victory having been reported, the admiral then died of his wounds, and Trafalgar remains as an inspiration to the United Nations in trouble. I take a chance on thus preaching rather than reporting today because spot news in Washington is not so hot. The Army, of course, is glad to have the President's order permitting the delineation of Jap-out areas on the West Coast. But Attorney General Biddle here cautions one and all that this is not martial law, such as you heard about from Jim Wall, was it, in Honolulu, wherein the right of habeas corpus is suspended and civil rights go glimmering. Of course, this is not an invitation to Japs and Nazis to try to beat the Army's evacuation orders with the courts. However, when the Dyes Committee yellow paper comes out next week, I think the public will get a glimpse in long detail of some of the Jap activities in spy work along the West Coast. Congress slows down to a balk. It doesn't like some of the legislation handed to the leaders. But from now on until Tuesday, the main activity in Congress will be hearing some orator read George Washington's farewell address and going back to the congressional offices to write to enraged constituents who are still boiling over, mad about pensions for congressmen. A matter which will be attended to first thing, I think, after Washington's birthday, the repeal of that provision of the law. Congress didn't like, too, and I say they're balking, Congress didn't like, doesn't like, the superlative overall plan to provide endless public works after the war, and the House threw that down, not because of the public works, but Congress has no objection to forward-looking statesmanship at all. But somehow or others, the voters seem not to like the connotation of the word planning. Look out for fireworks on the highly controversial thing called the War Powers Bill. Only 4 hours have been allowed by the hard-boiled House Committee on Rules for debate on this dynamite, which is loaded with extra authority for a lot of these special agencies, which seem to be under fire. But this is war, and the leadership is ready to mow them down if they get in the way. There's a row expected over the proposal to permit banks to buy government bonds direct from the Treasury. Opponents say it will work in reverse, that the Treasury will cram the bonds down the bankers' throats. The Rogers bill providing for the Women's Army Corps will be considered and passed by the House next week, I believe. So many women seem to think this corps has been established, but not yet. A ship-a-day schedule of the Maritime Commission is filling the waters with American cargoes will step up to 2 a day by May 1st. Bananas, one of nature's best slippers and more economical than petroleum grease, will be used today to launch the ship called the Cape Romano at Beaumont, Texas. 7,000 pounds of bananas to launch the ship. And that's all from Washington at this time.
That's the news of the day, ladies and gentlemen. These have been reports by John McVane from London, Jim Wall from Honolulu, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The program originally scheduled at this time will be delayed in order that we may bring you a special broadcast from the Far East War Zone. The National Broadcasting Company presents Martin Agronsky, noted NBC correspondent who's been heard in the past from Ankara, Turkey, Cairo, Athens, Singapore,
and more recently from Batavia, Java. From these points, he's covered various phases of the war as it spread across Europe and into the Orient. Agronsky has just arrived in Australia and will now bring to NBC listeners his first report from Sydney. Go ahead, Martin Agronsky.
This is Martin Agronsky calling from Sydney. Today I arrived here from the Dutch East Indies after a flight of a Dutch bomber through the Jap air patrols over Java in the Indian Ocean. In the area I left behind me, the Japs, with the capture of Singapore, had already accomplished the first phase of their drive for empire in the Far East. On the day I left Java, they had successfully attacked and captured Pelambang in southern Sumatra. As I flew over the Indian Ocean toward Australia, the Japs launched their attack on Bali, pissed off Java's southernmost tip. The outcome of the Allied defense of Bali is not yet completely known. It would take an incurable optimist to doubt the ultimate result. The Allied defenses there, as throughout the Far Eastern theater of war, are pitifully weak. With Bali in Japanese possession, Java will sit in a dangerous sandwich. From Sumatra across the narrow Sunda Straits to the north, from Bali to the south, from Borneo and the Celebes to the east, the Japs will be able to throw dangerously powerful forces at the Allied defenders of Java. The attack on Java, already begun from the air, is the last step in what can be described as the second phase of Japan's Asian offensive, that is, the capture of the Netherlands East Indies. In Java, I spoke with the commanders of the American and Dutch forces. They did not conceal that the battle for Java would be a grim fight against tremendous odds. I spoke in Java, too, with American soldiers, sailors, and airmen, with the fighting men of Britain and Holland. They echoed the words of their commanders. On the tongues of every man were the words, against tremendous odds. You must realize at home exactly what your sons and husbands are fighting against in this part of the world. You must know that every time an American pilot takes off to meet the Japs, he knows, before his machine leaves the ground, that if he's lucky, he'll be outnumbered by at least 5-1. If he runs into the usual Jap attacking formation, the odds against him will be 15-1. You must know that when land fighting starts in Java, the odds will be equally great. That in the seas throughout this entire area, the sailors of the American and Allied forces today and from the first day of our war have to face equally overwhelming odds. I don't know whether Java can be held. If 1,000 American fighter pilots and machines and another 500 battle pilots and machines were to arrive there today, the Allies would have a good chance of holding Java. Failing that, only the most brilliant Allied generalship or the most bungling kind of Japanese generalship could make Java's fate uncertain. The Allies have yet to produce a brilliant general. The Japs have yet to make a misstep in a bold, expertly conceived, and executed campaign. Java today means two things to the Allies. First, it provides, with the exception of Burma, where the Allied forces are steadily being pushed back, the only land base from which aerial offensive operations on a large scale can be undertaken against the Jap land, sea, and air forces in this part of the world. If the Allied forces are pushed back to Australia, will be forced almost completely onto the defensive. Second, it provides the only defensive base from which the Allies can threaten or hamper the Japanese concentration of all available forces in the southwestern Pacific for an attack on Australia itself. The fight for Java has begun. If Java falls, the fight for Australia, what must be recognized as the third phase of the Jap drive for empire in Asia, lies in the immediate future. There's no point in speculating as to whether Java will or will not hold. The next couple of weeks, perhaps even the next few days, will decide that. What is vital is that for once, the democratic nations do everything in their power, while there's still a lot of time, to create in Australia, at least, a force that will have a fighting chance of holding the Japs' victorious promenade toward the complete possession of the Far East. The Japs aren't supermen. They can be stopped if the lessons of morale, and in fact, of the entire Far Eastern campaign are not only recognized, but put to use. In Malaya, the British were not only outnumbered, but outsmarted and outgeneraled. Even admitting the original underestimation of the Jap strength put the British forces at a fatal disadvantage, it still remains true that from the first days of the campaign, the Japs gained nearly as much through their enemy's bungling as through their own well-executed attacks.
Time and again in the course of the British retreat, lack of organization gave the Japs intact airfields, petrol stores, and ammunition depots. The record can be found in the British communiques themselves. Time after time, the official communique announced the evacuation of airfields with a customary addendum: our forces destroyed petrol stores and hangars and rendered the airfield unusable. And then, 2 days later, again in an official communique, upon the announcement that British planes had successfully bombed the supposedly unusable hangars, runways, and petrol stores of the, I quote, successfully evacuated airdrome. When I left Singapore some 2 weeks ago, it was on board an Australian warship. On the docks at the naval base were piled thousands of pounds worth of war materials, unprotected, undispersed, a perfect target for the Jap bombers. Out in the Indian Ocean, our warship picked up a large convoy that for weeks had been on the high seas en route to Singapore from England. On board one ship of the convoy was a large number of RAF ground personnel, accompanied by a large number of fighter pilots, veterans of the Battle of Britain. In another ship were the crated planes the pilots were to fly. Mine and other warships took the convoy safely through the Banka Straits off Sumatra and into Singapore in the face of continual Jap bombing attacks. 3 days later in Java, I met one of the pilots. From him I learned that due to some stupid, and for some men on board, fatal blunder, the ship's destination had been mistaken. All the way out from England, the pilot told me, the men on board had voluntarily organized their unit so that they would be ready to go into action immediately they landed in Singapore. They had gotten in England a detailed map of Singapore Island. Realizing that the airdromes might be unusable, they had laid out on their map streets from which they could take off their fighters. The ground crews had drilled on board ship until they were letter perfect in the use of the Bofors and Bren guns they carried. Every detail of assembly of the crated planes had been worked out beforehand. They believed they could have their planes in the air and be functioning as an operational unit within 24 hours of landing. When these men arrived in Singapore, they found no one at the docks who even knew they were expected. After much searching, they reached an RAF headquarters officer and asked that they be allowed to go into action immediately. Instead, they were informed that as they were apparently not expected in Singapore, they could not operate there, but would have to go to Java and receive instructions from the high command. All this time, their ship was being heavily bombed at the dock. They finally got back to Java. I cannot reveal the number of their casualties. The pilot officer ended his story with a laconic remark, I quote, "It didn't improve our morale," unquote. This is only one example of an innumerable series of similar incidents. If on the British side of the Allied High Command such things are allowed to happen in times like these, we can't expect to stop the Japs. It's not too late to profit from such lessons. The men responsible can be changed. And on the American side, there's an equally pretty story. A few minutes after my plane landed at a certain small town, an American naval plane came in. An American naval lieutenant and his gunner were in the plane. The pilot told me it had flown to shore from an American warship, which I cannot name. The warship was convoying American troop ships to somewhere in Java. When the convoy was 6 hours at sea, the warship picked up a Jap broadcast from Tokyo, accurately describing both the makeup of the convoy and its destination. 2 hours later, 32 Jap bombers appeared overhead and bombed the convoy. The Japs hit one of the gun turrets of the warship. The 20-year-old machinist mate went into the gun turret, which was stacked with 6-inch shells and filled with flames from burning powder bags. The shells were red hot and could have exploded at any moment. The young machinist mate poured water on the red hot shell cases till a fire was put out. Being an American, I was proud of this story of courage. I told the lieutenant so and asked him if he'd shot down the Japs. He answered it was pretty hard to hit the Japs with the ammunition on board. I asked why. He explained that the anti-aircraft ammunition was 1930-1931 issue, and that when it had been tested a year ago, it was found to be only 30% effective. The lieutenant told me that it was impossible to range with this type of ammunition, as the bursts were too ununiformed to enable the gunners to work out a fire pattern. The lieutenant added that he would like to have been able to title the foremast of that warship the gentleman responsible for United States warships being equipped with this type of ammunition. He made me promise to tell this story to you people at home. If we hope to stop the Japs, the United States will have to do better than that. The men fighting in the far eastern countries for their defense, and ultimately for the defense of the United States, deserve better of their country than they're getting. On an isolated airfield somewhere in the far east, I found an all-American pilot in charge. He was a fighter pilot who had been grounded following a crash. One finger of his right hand was paralyzed. Because it got in his way, he was no longer permitted to fly. He told me he wouldn't be on the ground much longer, as he'd arranged to have the finger amputated so he could take a new medical examination he was sure he could pass. And against this spirit should be put the pronouncement of various American spokesmen that it would be best to keep the majority of American forces at home to defend America. Almost every American soldier with whom I've spoken in the far eastern theater of war has begged me to try to fight this kind of short-sighted view. It's a sincere belief of every American observer in this part of the world that first Singapore, then Java, and last Australia are the outer defenses of California. They feel equally that if we moved with all our power immediately, we would have a fighting chance to stop the Japs in Australia, even if Java fails. No matter what courage the Allies show, they can't stop the Japs with 10 and 15 to 1 odds against them. Just before I left Java, I interviewed a Dutch officer. On his word, he affirmed a quotation. It read, I quote, "It can scarcely be repeated too often that when a country is thrown on the defensive as regards its shoreline, the effectual function of the fleet is to take the offensive." Unquote. If you don't recognize that quotation the Dutchman had framed, I'll tell you who wrote it. Admiral Mahan, the United States naval strategist. This is Martin Agronsky returning you now to San Francisco.
You've just heard a special broadcast from Sydney, Australia. The speaker was Martin Agronsky, noted NBC correspondent, who has just arrived in Australia to cover the war in that sector. This program reached you through our newsroom in San Francisco. Have presented Melodic Strings, the music of Carl Kalash and his string ensemble. The program came to you from San Francisco. This is the National Broadcasting Company.